Hi there, I'm Dr. Trevor Cates. Welcome to the Spa Doctor podcast. On today's podcast, we're discussing Lyme disease. There's a lot of confusion and misinformation about Lyme disease out there. So I asked today's guest to come on the show and talk about it so we can clear up some of this. My guest is Dr. Darren Ingles. He is a respected leader in natural medicine with numerous publications, international lectures, and 30 years experience in the healthcare field. He received his Bachelor of Science degree in medical technology from Purdue University and worked as a clinical microbiologist and immunologist prior to attending medical school. He went on to receive his doctorate of naturopathic medicine from Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington. He is a licensed naturopathic doctor in both Connecticut and California. Dr. Ingles is author of the new book, The Lyme Solution, a five-part plan to fight the inflammatory autoimmune response and beat Lyme disease. In this interview, Dr. Ingles explains what exactly Lyme disease is, all the possible ways that you can get it, even beyond tick bites, as well as testing for it and treatment. So please enjoy this interview. Darren, it's so great to have you on my podcast. Welcome.
Oh, thanks, Trevor.
Yeah, so we're talking about Lyme disease today. And I think most people are familiar with what Lyme disease, that it's generally people think of it tick-borne illness and more common in certain parts of the country. But I think there are a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions around Lyme disease. So why don't you tell us from your perspective what Lyme disease is and how do you get Lyme disease?
Sure. Well, Lyme disease is a bacterial infection, and you usually get it through a tick bite. So we tend to see it more in regions of the country that tend to have a lot of ticks. And there's actually a very specific kind of tick that's known to transmit Lyme disease. So it's called a deer tick. And as you can imagine by the name, you know, it's transmitted through deer. So areas like, you know, New England and the central Midwest tend to be areas that are more common for Lyme. But realistically, you know, we're finding Lyme disease pretty much in every state throughout the country. So although it's more endemic in those regions, you know, like, you know, here in California, we're now seeing a higher incidence of Lyme than we have before. So what we're finding is that, you know, deer are the big carriers, but it's actually the smaller rodents that tend to carry these ticks. So it's rats and raccoons and squirrels, and obviously those go everywhere. So we're starting to see, you know, Lyme kind of spread throughout the country. So what happens is, you know, these ticks, they sit on an animal, they ride on the animal, then they get on a plant. You happen to brush up against that plant, and then the tick gets on you. So if the tick gets on your skin, it can bite you, much like a mosquito bite or a flea bite. And then when it bites you, it actually injects a little bit of its saliva through your skin and into your bloodstream. But it carries a bacteria, and it's a bacteria that's called a spirochete. So it's kind of a corkscrew-shaped organism. And when that organism gets in your bloodstream, it starts to potentially cause, you know, what we now call Lyme disease.
Okay, great. So what about getting tested for Lyme disease? How do people find out if they have it?
You know, the testing, unfortunately, has been a big problem in this country. You know, the test that we do is a blood test. So the CDC has recommended what they call a two-tier test. So you do a Lyme screen test, which is an antibody test. And if that test is positive, then it goes over to another test called a Western blot. Unfortunately, we found in the research is that this testing is only about 43% sensitive, which means is what are the likelihood that it'll pick up the illness if you actually have it? What that translates to is that it doesn't even pick up half the people who actually have the disease. So we have a lot of problems with Lyme testing. Unfortunately, you know, this has been the gold standard for, you know, 40 years. Now, there are some newer labs out there that offer better specialized testing, and their sensitivity seems to be a lot better. So I recommend, you know, if you feel like you might have Lyme disease, to work with your doctor and use one of these labs that has better sensitivity.
Right. And there are doctors that specialize in Lyme disease, right? Especially some functional medicine and naturopathic physicians that specialize on Lyme disease. It seems like they know a lot more about these types of tests than, you know, people that don't specialize in Lyme, because it definitely is a specialty.
Right. And you'll see the term that's called a Lyme literate MD or Lyme literate ND, you know, medical doctor, naturopathic doctor. So these are doctors that have specialized training in Lyme disease. And they tend to be, you know, very knowledgeable on the different types of testing that's available. You know, one of the problems we run into with the testing, too, is that when we first discovered Lyme disease, and for people who don't know, Lyme disease was named after Lyme, Connecticut. That's where they first discovered the disease in a group of children that were diagnosed with what was called juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which is actually a very rare condition. It just so happens there were a lot of kids in this area that had that problem. And of course, many years later discovered it actually wasn't that, it was actually, you know, Lyme disease, but that was named after Lyme, Connecticut. But when they first discovered this bacteria, they found it was a strain called Borrelia burgdorferi. What we've now learned is that there's about 100 strains of Borrelia in this country. Maybe of those 100, 12 to 16 actually can cause Lyme disease. But our testing is still only looking for that one strain. So part of the challenges that we're running into is that, you know, we've been looking for the one strain and not really looking at all the strains. Now, there is a lab that just started last year that is now offering a blood test that has a sequence. It's a DNA sequence that's actually common to all the Borrelia species. So I think, you know, as technology continues to develop, we have a better chance of, you know, picking up the different strains of these Borrelia organisms that can cause Lyme.
And which labs are the ones that you generally are working with? Do you mind sharing that?
Yeah, so the labs that I generally work with, there's a lab out of Palo Alto called iGenX. iGenX has really been one of the leaders in Lyme testing for many years. There's another lab out of New Jersey called Medical Diagnostics Lab. They do very similar testing to iGenX. And then this new lab that just came on the scene is called Global Lyme Diagnostics. And they're the ones that are looking at that sequence that's common to all Borrelia. So, you know, no test is 100% perfect. You know, often we're doing multiple tests and sometimes testing people multiple times to try and pick it up. But, you know, at the end of the day, Lyme disease is really a clinical diagnosis. So it's based on your symptoms more than just what we find on the piece of paper.
Right. And I want to talk about those symptoms. But first, before we go into that, besides getting it from a tick, what are some of the other ways people can get Lyme disease?
Well, some of the research coming out of Europe suggests that you can actually get it from mosquito bites too. I haven't done any research here in the United States showing that, but there's been at least a handful of studies out of Europe showing that both mosquitoes and or fleas may be transmitting it. So it makes a lot of sense because I see people who live in areas that aren't necessarily endemic for deer ticks that get Lyme disease. So it's possible that there's some other insect that's transmitting it as well.
Yeah, I know even in Utah, there are quite a few cases of Lyme disease here, and people were not traveling, and there just aren't many bugs here. So it's interesting. So can you get it human-to-human contact?
You know, that's a great question. And the truth is, we don't really know. And what I will say is, when you look at the research, you know, particularly in like mom to baby, you would think, since it's a blood-borne organism, that the baby would be very susceptible. What the research shows is that moms that have Lyme disease, their children have a higher incidence of birth defects, but not necessarily that the child gets Lyme disease. Now, in saying that, I have seen a lot of patients that mom had Lyme disease, and when the child is born, they suffer from developmental delays and other, you know, potential neurological issues. So my personal opinion is that I think Lyme does get transmitted from mother to baby. The other question that comes up a lot is through sexual contact. Again, the research hasn't really demonstrated that it is sexually transmitted. Because it is a blood-borne organism and because it is transmitted through a bite of a tick, I don't think casual contact is probably likely to spread it. Perhaps if there is a blood-to-blood transmission, it's possible, but the research hasn't really shown that.
Yeah, interesting. It'll be interesting to see what more comes of this with more research and what we can learn more about how people are actually getting Lyme disease, because we're seeing more and more of it. And it does look like other conditions. So let's talk about some of the signs and symptoms, because it seems like a lot of people get diagnosed with something else and then later down the road maybe find out that they actually have Lyme disease.
Right. Well, you know, in my practice, it's kind of like if you've had a condition that's been longstanding and you can't find out what it is, you know, you have to kind of look at Lyme. You know, they call Lyme the great mimic. You know, it looks like a lot of other different illnesses, particularly a lot of other autoimmune diseases. So things like, you know, MS and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. You know, if you ask your doctor, well, even if you're diagnosed with that condition, why do I have that? You know, they're going to shrug their shoulders. They don't know. So I think it's possible that Lyme can be a catalyst for these conditions to develop. But when you look at the symptoms, you know, they're vague, and there's over 100 symptoms that have been associated with Lyme disease. And I sort of break it down into what happens when you get acute Lyme disease versus what we now call kind of chronic Lyme disease. You know, when you get acute Lyme disease, generally you're very ill. You know, you feel sick. So you can get a headache, fever, chills, joint pain. And one of the features that's sort of characteristic of Lyme is what we call wandering joint pain. So one day it's my right knee, the next day it's my left shoulder, the next day it's my left ankle. And you'll see the sort of migratory pain, which I have never seen any other condition that causes that other than Lyme. You can also get a condition called Bell's palsy, where half of your face starts to droop. You can get swollen lymph nodes. You can feel very, very tired. And you can get other miscellaneous sort of neurological symptoms. The classic symptom, though, is what we call a bullseye rash. So the spot at where the tick bites you leaves this sort of looks like a target on your skin that will start fairly small and will spread over the course of weeks to months. So when you see that, that's a hands down slam dunk. You know you have Lyme disease.
Yeah. And what percentage of people actually get the bullseye lesion? I mean, because I remember in medical school when I went, you know, that was 20 years ago, that they, you know, that was part of the disease picture, is you would have that bullseye lesion. And it's nice to know as a doctor signs like that, especially, you know, like as a skin, you know, specializing in skin, if you see something on the outside, that's a great indication. But there seem to be so many cases now that people don't even notice it or don't have it.
Yeah, you know, the CDC says that 70 to 80% of the people who get Lyme disease will get the rash. But if you look at the research, it's actually probably less than 40% and maybe even under 30%. So certainly in my practice, it's less than half. So we can't use that as a reliable marker as whether you've been exposed or not. But if you do see it, you know, you're pretty confident that, you know, you've been exposed to Lyme.
Yeah, yeah. And then what are the sort of the chronic symptoms, the ongoing symptoms?
Right. So what happens is after you've had it for a while, you know, the symptoms tend to change. And although you can still have a lot of the symptoms that we see in acute Lyme disease, we start to see more neurological symptoms. So it can be things like balance and coordination problems, memory loss, you know, sometimes a cognitive impairment. People just become very forgetful. People will describe themselves as being clumsy. You can also get what's called neuropathy. It's numbness and tingling in your hands and your feet and sometimes other places on the skin. And, you know, being a skin specialist, one of the things that I hear a lot is what we call a sensory distortion. People will feel a buzzing in their skin, a burning in their skin. And you'll look at their skin and it'll look completely normal. But there's something that's happened to the nerve that goes to the skin that's being altered. And that's why they feel this sensation. So when we start to see these other neurological symptoms, again, particularly if you've ruled out everything else, you know, that puts, you know, Lyme really kind of at the top of our list.
And so things like fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome, arthritis, those can be some of the things that people have been diagnosed with, right? And then finding Absolutely. Out that there actually is a Lyme component.
Yeah, you know, again, I think a lot of these conditions are sort of vague diagnoses, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, you know, I mean, what does that really mean? It's just a collection of symptoms. So again, it doesn't really explain what the root of the cause is. And I think for a lot of people, and certainly my experience has been a lot of folks who get that diagnosis, Lyme is part of their underlying problem. In fact, the one that I probably see the most is MS. In my practice, you know, multiple sclerosis is Lyme disease until proven otherwise. And what's really interesting is that if you do an MRI on somebody with MS and an MRI on somebody with Lyme, the lesions that you can get on the brain look identical. So it's pretty much impossible to differentiate the two just from imaging studies. So when I see somebody with MS, you know, the first thing we do is we look at Lyme.
Right. And so because of the memory loss, maybe also dementia, Alzheimer's, you know, early stages of Alzheimer's, it might be looking like that as well. Yes.
Yeah. In fact, there was a very well-known case of a famous actor, Kris Kristofferson, about a year and a half or 2 years ago, was diagnosed with early stage dementia. And actually one of my colleagues discovered that he had Lyme disease. And after he got treated for Lyme disease, his dementia completely cleared up. So I think, you know, a lot of people were seeing, particularly again with early onset dementia, that would be something we would want to investigate to make sure that's not part of what's causing that.
Okay, great. So let's talk about treatment. I'm sure everybody's ready to hear about that now because what you just said was it was able to be reversed. The symptoms were able to be reversed, which is really great news, especially when we're talking about some of these types of symptoms that you've mentioned, and some of the diseases that somebody may have been diagnosed with a prognosis of, yeah, sorry, this is just how your life's going to be. This can give people some hope if they can get tested and then get treatment. So what is the treatment for Lyme that you're finding most successful?
Yeah, so, you know, for somebody with acute Lyme disease, I mean, antibiotics really are the best course of action. You know, again, the research shows and just clinically we know that when you get early treatment, antibiotics can be successful at eradicating Lyme and really preventing it from going on to cause any further problems. What happens for a lot of people is they don't get early diagnosis and it stays in their body for months to years. And so by the time they figure out what's going on, antibiotics at that point don't tend to be as effective. So what I've discovered is that, you know, the longer you've had Lyme, it sort of morphs from an infection really into an autoimmune condition. So you have to treat it more as an autoimmune disease than just a straight infection. So I've actually been using herbs to help support the body, really kind of help the terrain function better so that your body's better equipped to deal with both the infection part and the autoimmune part. So, you know, there's many different herbal protocols that are out there that people read about it. You know, there's probably at least, you know, 8 or 9 that I know of and probably a bunch that I don't know of. But I found 2 different herbal protocols I've used with patients. And, you know, I had Lyme disease myself. So I've been through this as a patient as much as a doctor. And when I had Lyme disease, I was on antibiotics for almost 9 months and it practically, you know, killed me. It really, you know, I lost 25 pounds. My gut was a mess. I felt terrible and it really wasn't getting to the root of the problem. So I actually found a doctor in New York City who's a Chinese herbalist and has a series of Chinese herbs. His name's Dr. Zhang, Zhang. And his herbs really pulled me out of the weeds. And since then, I've really kind of used his protocol as my primary treatment for at least adults with Lyme disease. And so when you look at what the herbs are doing, again, they're really helping, you know, go after the infection if there's anything still there. It's helping support the immune system. It's helping improve your circulation. It's got some anti-inflammatory, analgesic effects. So it's really covering the bases of everything that Lyme can do to your body. But I like the fact that it's really supporting your body versus breaking it down. And then beyond that, there's another protocol. There's a doctor named Lee Cowden, who is a cardiologist in Dallas. And he started using a group of liquid tinctures that all grow from the Amazon and down in that area. And in fact, his protocol has been researched by a woman at the University of New Haven named Dr. Eva Sappi. And she found that the herbs actually work better than the antibiotics. So, you know, we've got several different herbal protocols, and it's really just a function of, you know, the person, whether they can take pills or liquids. But I just want people to know that there are a lot of different options available and that they really just need to work with their doctor and, you know, finding out which one is better suited for them.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because with antibiotics, that's certainly standard of care and what's typically used and certainly the training that we get when we're in medical school. But part of the issue with Lyme disease is gut dysbiosis, right? So when you're taking antibiotics, especially as long as a lot of people end up having to do like you did, then you're creating more gut dysbiosis issues, which seems would make the chronic symptoms worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, people kind of forget what antibiotics are really doing to the body. You know, when you start disrupting, you know, your normal gut bugs, you know, that has a big impact on your immune system. You know, 80% of your immune function comes from your gut. So when your gut's not functioning well, your immune system's not going to function well. So I think, you know, the longer people are on antibiotics, obviously the greater likelihood you have of changing that whole gut ecology. So we want to preserve that balance so that your immune system does what we want it to do. And, you know, when you look at some animal studies, you know, we know that a single dose of disrupt that gut flora for up to 6 months. So you can imagine what's happening now with people when they're on antibiotics for months to even years. And I've seen some Lyme patients that have been on antibiotics for 10 years, 12 years. I can only imagine, you know, what that's done to the gut and, you know, how long would it take for the gut to actually recover? You know, we don't really know the answer to that. But my experience has been that, you know, if we use things, again, that are more supportive of the gut, instead of breaking it down, we get better clinical success.
Right. Okay, great. And so then other treatments that you find to be particularly helpful, do you recommend IVs and other types of treatments?
Yeah, I think, we start looking at what are the more specific symptoms that bother each Lyme patient. For some people, the fatigue is more problematic. For other people, it's the joint pain. So there's a lot of things we can do nutritionally to support the body. We'll do IV nutrients. IV vitamin C can be very beneficial, or what we call a Myers cocktail, which is just a combination of various, vitamins and minerals. There's a lot of things, for people who don't have access to IVs that you can do orally. There's a lot of nutritional supplements and herbs that you can take just by mouth to help support your immune system, improve your circulation, improve your fatigue. So I think it kind of really depends on what is more problematic for each person. And I do talk about this in my book about, each of the different symptoms and what you can do to try and help support that area of your body.
Yeah, because it really varies from patient to patient, right? Because it depends on what else is going on with their health, what genetic factors they have, what other illnesses they may have or have had, their general or medical history, and a lot of the environmental exposures and.
Well, and you just hit the nail on the head is environmental exposure. One thing I probably find most common with Lyme patients is mold. It's hard to find any place in this country where there isn't mold. And for whatever reason, people with Lyme tend to be very sensitive to mold, and whether it's mold allergy or what we call mycotoxicity. If you've been living in a water damaged home or you work in a water damaged building, some molds can secrete these toxins that, when you breathe them in, can damage your nervous system, damage your lungs. But the symptoms of mold exposure and Lyme disease are almost identical. Living up in Connecticut, where we have a lot of mold, it's always important to, as part of your differential diagnosis, to try and figure out, is it just Lyme or is it Lyme and mold? And in some cases, we treat their Lyme and, they get a little bit better, but it's really not until we address their mold that they get a lot better. So it's always very important to be very cognizant of, your entire environmental exposure. And, mold is probably the biggest issue, but, it's everything else that you're exposed to. It's what you're putting on your skin. It's what you're putting on your hair, right? It's all these toxic chemicals that add to your total load, your body burden. So anything you can do to reduce that stress on your body, again, is ultimately going to help your immune system.
Right. And when you say address mold, I'm guessing you're talking about addressing mold in the home and getting rid of the mold, but also addressing the issues that the person has physically going on, their symptoms associated with the mold exposure.
Yeah, obviously, if you're living in a water damaged building, you want to fix it. If you continue to be in a problematic environment, that will continue to create symptoms in you. So if you know that you have, a leak in your roof or a leak in your basement, you want to get that fixed, as soon as possible. But once you've had that exposure, you want to seek some sort of active treatment to start pulling particularly mycotoxins out of your body, because your body sort of has a limited capacity to get rid of it on its own. So, we typically use things like binding agents, like, activated charcoal or bentonite clay, take those mycotoxins and pull them out of your body. And if you've got mold allergy, we can do different things with immunotherapy. So kind of like allergy shots, we can start desensitizing you against the effect of what the mold spores do to your immune system. So depending on what the problem is, and if you've had exposure to mold, you could be allergic to mold spores, you could have exposure to mycotoxins. They're both treated differently, and in some cases we do have to deal with both. But part of my process is to go through and take stock of, again, everything in your environment that might be adding to your load, and you just kind of treat each one individually.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what about other things that can support someone recovering from Lyme disease, like diet, for example? What kind of dietary recommendations do you recommend?
I've tried a lot of different diets with Lyme patients over the years, and everything from, an anti-candida diet to paleo to, keto. And the diet that I've found seems to help most people, that's also, I'll say, maybe the easiest to stick to, is what I call an alkaline diet. So an alkaline diet is really about eating foods that promote better alkaline pH in your body. And it's independent of the pH of the food. So for people who don't know what pH is, pH is really talking about whether something creates acid in the body or alkaline or alkalinity. So there's been some research, many years ago that looked at, how alkaline diet affects your body. And what it's really trying to do is affect it at the cellular level. So it doesn't change your blood pH. Your blood pH is actually very tightly regulated, but it actually starts to change the pH within your cells. But that's where all the action's happening. That's where, your enzymes and all this activity is really going on. So if we can improve that, we improve the function of the cell. So, trying to get to the most deep level of the body, I think this is a way to do it. And, in a nutshell, what an alkaline diet really means is that you're eating mostly a vegetarian diet. You really try and limit your animal protein, so that's meats, fish, eggs, to about 20-25% of your total dietary intake. And really, we remove all junk food, processed food, candy, cookies, that kind of stuff, plus coffee and plus dairy. All these foods tend to be very acid-forming in the body. And what acid does chemically to the body is it creates inflammation. So our ultimate goal through this diet is really to help reduce inflammation.
Okay. All right. Great. Great tips on diet. Now, what about other things like exercise, stress management, those sorts of things, sleep?
Yeah. I think most of the people I see with Lyme, sleep is probably one of their biggest hurdles. For whatever reason, after they get exposed, even for people who always slept well their whole life, now they don't sleep well. They're not getting deep restorative sleep. And we know certainly from a neurological standpoint, your neurons repair themselves when you get into that deep restorative sleep. So if you're missing that, we have to do pretty much everything we can to get your sleep pattern on track. So again, we have a lot of natural substances in our dispensary that we can use to induce, better quality sleep. So I use a lot of, 5-hydroxytryptophan, 5-HTP. Again, research has shown that that's helpful in getting, a deeper sleep. I use a lot of an amino acid called glycine. Glycine is a very safe amino acid that you can eat, and that can help, again, induce deeper sleep. I think where a lot of people suffer in their sleep is even if they fall asleep okay, they don't stay asleep. I think that's probably the bigger problem. So again, anything we can do to help facilitate that deeper sleep is going to help. And sort of on the heels of that, goes with exercise, because moving your body is part of the way that you can help get better sleep. And for a lot of people with Lyme disease, they physically don't feel well, so exercise can be challenging. But at the most fundamental level, I find even for people who have some physical disability, even stretching can be a thing you can do easily at home, when it's convenient for you. But that still is movement. It's still, stretching the muscle, improving blood flow. And so any kind of body movement, I encourage to what your body will handle.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else that you want to add to this, the treatment, overall treatment that you like to use for supporting people with Lyme?
Well, I think, there's a big psychological component to this too. When you've been dealing with a chronic illness, I think it emotionally can wear on you. And so I just encourage people, if they've been dealing with this, to, reach out to other people, find support groups, find a way to manage your stress, and whether it's through meditation, Tai Chi, it's whatever works for you. But, I know how it is when you feel bad about burdening your friends and your family and they're tired of hearing about it. And I see so many people that feel very isolated. And I think that that becomes a big challenge. So I just want to encourage people to, reach out to a greater community. And there's a lot of people out there dealing with the same issues. So, find that that person or people that can really help support you emotionally while you're going through your treatment.
And do you provide support community for the people that you see?
We do. We actually have a Facebook page that we invite people with Lyme disease to come join, where I actually work with a woman who is a therapist, social worker by training. She herself has had Lyme disease. So we sort of co-manage this page together, and we're there to help give, positive support, encouragement, and then, useful tips to help people, get through their day-to-day life.
And is that open to anyone? So people watching, listening to this, or do they need to reach out to you to be invited? How does that work?
Yeah. So if you go to our website, it's DarrenIngallsND.com. There's a link to our Facebook page, and they can just click on that and join the community.
Okay, great.
Very easy.
I think that's fantastic. It's great that you have that for people, because You've had Lyme disease yourself, and so you know the challenges that people experience, and it's nice to be able to provide support to people and connect with others. So I appreciate that you're doing that, and thanks for sharing that. We'll also put the link up to your website below the podcast, your podcast interview, so people can find that. Also, with your book, your new book, tell everybody about that and why they might want to consider getting it.
Yeah. So I have a new book that will be coming out March 27th. It's called The Lyme Solution. And again, it's really drawn out of my experience as a Lyme patient, as much as now having treated thousands of Lyme patients on, you know, what works. And so I wrote this book for, you know, you, the Lyme patient. It's really a step-by-step guide that you can use to help navigate your own condition. It's something you can share with your doctor, and they can also help guide you through the different process. But it's really a five-step plan where we talk about, again, how to improve gut health, you know, how to, you know, follow a diet that's manageable, how to treat the infection. And I go through, you know, all the different herbal protocols with specific doses. And then I get in more into, you know, dealing with mold and these other toxins in the environment. And then the last part of that, again, is really about, you know, how to manage your stress, what kind of exercise you can do, how to get better sleep. And then I have another section that's really something you would need to work with your doctor. These are medically managed therapies. But I think I've tried myself what I find works, what I find works for other people. So, you know, this is my hope for people with Lyme disease, is that this will be a guide that's going to help you get over the hump.
Yes. And I encourage people, if you've checked out this interview, if you listen, you watch, and you think, okay, this is something I need to learn more about, this is a great way to learn more is through this book. And I know we can't cover everything in the interview, so this is a great way to learn more. And it also seems like a good thing to be able to take with you to a doctor's appointment. So if you're meeting with a Lyme specialist, and you can already have a little bit of information and share that with your doctor and come up with a plan together.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, it's a very straightforward, here you go kind of approach. And I think, you know, if you're working with a Lyme literate doctor, they're already going to be very open-minded to, you know, the kind of things I talk about. So I just encourage you to read the book yourself, share it with your doctor, your practitioner, and I think you'll find a lot of very useful information that'll help you get over Lyme disease.
Okay, great. Well, Darren, thanks so much for coming on today and sharing your information. I really appreciate it. Good luck with your book launch.
Great. Thanks, Trevor.
I hope you enjoyed this interview today with Dr. Darren Ingles and learned some things about Lyme disease that you may not have been aware about. And if you want to learn more, also maybe get Dr. Ingles' new book on Lyme disease, you go to thespadoctor.com, go to the podcast page with his interview, and you'll find all the information and links there. And while you're there, I invite you to join the Spa Doctor community. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you don't miss any of our upcoming shows. If you haven't done so already, I highly recommend you get your customized skin report at theskinquiz.com. It's free, takes just a few moments, and you can find out what information your skin is trying to tell you about your overall health and what you could do about it. Just go to theskinquiz.com. Also, I invite you to join me on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram, and YouTube, and join the conversation there. And I'll see you next time on the Spa Doctor Podcast.